KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. The housing market is up, but what does that really mean? Seattle Times economic columnist John Talton joins us later this hour with more on the recovery. Also, film critic Robert Horton pays a weekly visit. We're going to talk about last films by directors and actors. It's been a month since a train carrying a load of oil exploded in a small town in Quebec. The blizzard of lawsuits has started to fall, but beyond that, what lessons have officials, townspeople, environmentalists, and the oil industry learned? Vaughn Palmer's on vacation. We're joined by Les Lane, the provincial affairs columnist for Victoria Times Columnist. Hi, Les.
Morning, Marcy.
Can you remind listeners about the details of the oil train explosion?
Yeah, certainly. July 6th, middle of the night, a very pretty little town in Quebec called Lac-Megantic, a few thousand people, and a rail train, 70-odd cars full of crude oil, rolled out of control through town, derailed, and exploded right in the heart of this little village. And it was absolutely catastrophic damage, just a remarkably intense explosion, searing flames. Destroyed three or four blocks in the heart of town, and there was a very popular bar in the middle of town. A lot of people there fled out of there, and the count now is 42 confirmed dead and 5 missing. It looks like the body count's going to be about 47 people all told. It just rocked the entire country, and it has for for the 4 weeks since that happened.
As I understand it, Vaughn and has discussed some of the ongoing investigation about this. What was partly at fault was there weren't enough brakes set on the train?
Yeah, there's still a pretty high degree of confusion about exactly what went on. This train stopped for the night at a few miles away at a higher elevation in a little town, Nantes, further back on the line. They had some kind of relatively minor fire there. A fire crew came and extinguished it on the train, and then the train was parked and left for the night. And there's all sorts of pretty questionable findings about the routine kind of standards of safety on this rail line. It was apparently left unguarded or unmanned. The engineer caught a cab and went to stay the night as standard practice in the actual village further down the line in Lac-Megantic. And the train, the brakes in some fashion or other failed, and the thing just started inching downhill, gaining momentum, and then it was going full steam by the time it ran the couple of miles into Megantic. And I think it'll take a pretty intense series of investigations to exactly find these circumstances. One of the things that's been striking about this is that it's a tiny little railway, Montreal, Maine, and Atlantic Railway, owned by an Illinois kind of firm that specializes in niche railways around the world. And Mr. Burkhart, the CEO of that company, showed up in town, obviously, and there's a lot of head scratching going on about the company's kind of corporate response to this thing. He's a very blunt-spoken man. He arrived and started blaming the firemen right away for shutting the power down on the train, which controlled at least some of the brakes. And then he shifted stories and kind of blamed the engineer and just didn't really display an overwhelming sense of sensitivity to the scope of this disaster. So it's left kind of he's changed his attitude back and forth sort of over the intervening weeks on this thing, but he's got off on a bad start in terms of the typical response you'd expect from a corporation that's in some fashion responsible for this catastrophe.
Now, there is also some question about what kind of crude oil was actually on the train.
Yeah, this is striking. The backdrop to this thing is there's been a protracted debate in Canada over the last couple of years over the shipment of crude oil, one way or the other. Obviously, the oil sands and the Keystone, that's kind of the international story, and a national debate also about getting Alberta crude from the northern fields off to the coast to shipment or to Asia. There's a big bonanza waiting to be made there. if you can get this landlocked oil to some sort of coast. A lot of environmental opposition to pipelines in the last year or so. Movement by rail has been coming up as an option on a much, much larger scale than the Montreal, Maine, and Atlantic uses. Anyway, that's the backdrop to this thing. And this oil, through various intermediaries and companies, shipping companies, is called Bakken crude. It's from the North Dakota shale fields. It's kind of a byproduct of the gas exploration there. They're finding crude oil. But the extent of this fire is quite startling to anyone who conceives this crude oil as being kind of relatively inert in terms of volatility, because it just exploded and the ferocity of the fire, it took days to put it out. They're finding now that the particular oil found in the shale fields has hydrogen sulfide in it, and they're sort of leaning towards the theory that it's a lot more volatile than you would expect, and therefore a lot more dangerous, which goes back to the safety standards that were used on this railway.
Well, you mentioned a couple of minutes ago the great debate over the pipeline versus train shipment of crude oil, no matter where. The Keystone XL pipeline is a huge issue in the United States as well. Has anything concrete come out in the aftermath of this explosion, either an increased call for safety standards or another review of trains versus pipelines?
The investigations by our Transportation Safety Board, they take a long time. I'm sure it's the same in the United States as well. It's a full-on forensic examination of a lot of evidence. So I would think answers to that kind of thing are a couple of years away. In the meantime, this train, the railway's still running. I think they've beefed up their standards quite voluntarily. There's been no kind of national instant response in terms of safety standards, although everybody is going by the book a lot more than they used to. And the question is whether the book is still evident. And obviously, there's a raft of lawsuits that are piling on one after the other, too many to count at this point. The governments are responding. There's some disaster response and whatnot. But the core issue on this thing is whether I think rail cars are safe and whether the safety standards that are applying to them now are nearly stringent enough. I'm by no means a rail expert. There's just really questionable things on the face of it in terms of having just one man. This railway was in financial trouble for years before it got this crude oil contract a few years ago, and they were cost-cutting and whatnot. The train track maintenance and the operational standards are reduced. The idea of just having one man in charge of 73 cars full of crude oil sort of makes you shake your head or question it right off the bat. Hmm. And then various other standards in terms of leaving a parked train unattended as well. All those things I think will be sorted out, but it is going to take a while.
We're talking with Les Lane, provincial affairs columnist for the Victoria Times columnist. Now, staying on the topic of oil, I want to talk about the money aspect. British Columbia has got huge deposits of oil and gas as well, and I understand that provincial leaders are counting on money from that to fill your coffers.
We got a government here that is committed to LNG, finding gas and compressing it, shipping it offshore. And we're already raking in huge dollars in the Northeast in terms of oil and gas exploration, which leads governments to make very bold predictions in terms of the revenue that's really coming in over the long haul. But the tax agency has come up with a bit of a finding or a pointer towards a problem in terms of the fact that they might be overestimating the money, because one isolated little study has found a lot of people are cheating on the taxes up there. The tax agency did a kind of a specific small-scale pilot project audit of just two or three occupations in the oil and gas fields, and I don't think it looks like they tried very hard. They came up with $2 million in unpaid taxes and levied $500,000 in fines. So I think they're finding enough to go on and move in a big way against tax cheats in the resource sector.
And this is interesting. They were looking at couriers, paramedics, and the drivers who work for these firms. So they're not even talking about the owners of the corporations that are extracting these natural resources.
Exactly. No, this is very much just looking at the medium, you know, the very small-time medium income earners. And just three specific occupational groups there, the flaggers or the pilot car drivers and these itinerant kind of paramedics. Every job site needs a paramedic or an ambulance mm-hmm. attendant by law. So there's apparently a few of them that just drive around, kind of live out of their cars. They're out in very remote locations, and they're on hand and just live by their cell phones. So there's a lot of cash on the table kind of occupational contracts going on up there. It looks like something they've concluded that the resource sector, if you're going to down here in the capital, the government kind of simplifies things and looks at these as great big revenue generators, but you have to itemize that revenue to make sure it comes in. So I think the tax agency is looking at beefing up a lot of the inspections on these small timers. They have their hands full dealing with big time tax cheats as well. Hmm. There's been some special cases about a number of people found with accounts in Liechtenstein and tax dodge places like that. Hmm. But they are going to move on the small timers as well, apparently, by the looks of it.
Now, while we're talking about regulations, I want to end with a rather grisly story that's prompted increased regulations. Two little boys in New Brunswick were apparently killed by an escaped rock python.
Yeah, this is just a ghastly story that's the talk, coffee table talk across the country. It's just a horrifying case. 2, 4, and 6-year-old boys in an apartment above a specialty reptile exotic animal shop were found dead Saturday morning with a 100-pound African rock python, I think is the type of snake. The snake undoubtedly killed them. There's lots of questions why, but it's just revolted the entire country in terms of how something like this could happen. And a lot of people now are kind of checking exotic pet regulation and legislation across the country.
Now, in fact, they were above this exotic pet shop. They were the guests of the owner of the shop and having a sleepover with his son, right?
That's right. Initially, it was thought the animal slithered out of the cage on the ground floor shop, but the animal was in a fairly big glass enclosed container in the actual apartment above the shop, found a tiny little crack, got into the ventilation system overnight, and then I'm not clear on exactly how, but it got into the ventilation system, and then the duct that it was in collapsed into the apartment, and the animal slithered out into the apartment where the two little boys were sleeping together on the floor. There's some snake experts who know this animal's behavior, and just they're utterly mystified at how something like this could happen in terms of the animal. Not to get too grisly on this, but the animal sort of reacts in different ways, and they can't make any sense out of this at all. It does make you wonder how two little boys could succumb to this animal, but they're trying to figure that out. I'm not sure if they'll have much luck.
A fascinating story, and prompting more regulation of exotic animals like rock pythons and monkeys and things that maybe weren't destined to be pets in the first place.
Yeah, you always wonder about that. Across the country, it's an entirely different patchwork depending on province by province and even municipality by municipality. There's a 100 different rules and regulations. BC in British Columbia came up with a fairly comprehensive listing of about 1,000 animals that are specifically regulated. Many of them are completely outlawed, but some of them are grandfathered, and then you can buy anything in the world on the internet anytime you want. So if you want to go unregulated, apparently it's fairly easy to get around these laws.
Les, thanks for taking time to talk about these stories with us.
Nice to chat with you, Marcy. Take care.
You too. Les Lane is provincial affairs columnist for the Victoria Times columnist. Vaughn Palmer's on summer vacation. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
68 degrees in Seattle and mostly sunny, expecting to reach 85 this afternoon.
Support for KUOW comes from Foster Pepper, providing patent, trademark, copyright, and IP litigation legal services for small regional companies to Fortune 100 corporations. Online at foster.com and on Twitter. When it happens, Foster Pepper is there.
Hello again, I'm Marvin Alney. On the next To The Point, the American dream, a big house with a nice backyard on a quiet cul-de-sac, is changing. Central cities are growing faster than suburbs, where crime and poverty rates are increasing. When urban centers are safer and denser, can the suburbs survive? Will anyone want to live there anymore? Next time on To The Point from Public Radio International.
That's this morning at 11:15 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:22.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
The sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate bars and the candy.
Chocolate bars, yum yum. Time for a trip to the movies once again. Film critic Robert Horton is with us. In the summer, when we're not necessarily thinking about ends, you have given a little thought to final films by directors and actors. And when I heard that this was the topic that we were to be speaking of, I maybe jumped the gun a little because I immediately went to Jean-Louis Trintignant and Emmanuel Riva in Amour, which I don't think they planned for that to be their final films, but they're both in their mid-80s.
That is true.
So
don't want to be too morbid, but yes.
That would be a good exit. You would call that an excellent exit.
That certainly would be. That would be quite a lovely exit, yeah. And it's funny. It's just a funny thing that one thinks about from time to time, I suppose, if one thinks about films at all, is that some people seem to have this it's either planning or it's just sheer total luck of having a nice swan song of going out on some just exactly right sort of note. And then there are other people who have really good careers, people that whose work we might have enjoyed, who for one reason or another you think, wow, that was that person's last film. Ooh, that hurts.
Well, sometimes it is an accident. This is a little clip from Robert Altman, the great director. This is from his final film, Prairie Home Companion.
A Prairie Home Companion. It was a live radio variety show. The kind that died 50 years ago. But somebody forgot to tell them until this night. A big corporation down in Texas had bought up the radio station.
Well, this isn't really going to be your last show, is it?
Every show's your last show. That's my philosophy.
Thank you, Plato.
It was curtains, and everybody knew it.
A lot of good people up there. These folks put their lives into this.
Well, now they can put their lives into something else.
You're going to say something about it. How about just a moment of silence?
Silence on the radio. I don't know how that works.
Way down upon.
So this is an interesting film because you heard Garrison Keillor in the mix of people. But this wasn't a documentary. This was kind of a fictionalized Prairie Home Companion. I actually saw the film. And you put this on your good list.
Yes, it was turned out to be a really nice final film for Robert Altman in maybe an unexpected way, but it played to a lot of his strengths, like ensemble casts. As you said, it wasn't about Garris Keillor, who famously is in charge of that show. It was about this kind of horizontal group of more than a dozen people who played prominent roles. And it was also a movie that was about artifice and creating something, and Altman, I think, was very interested in that. And it was about ending.
Mm-hmm. Did he know this was going to be his final film?
This gets into the realm of he must have had some sense that it certainly could be, because he was in failing health at that time. And the script for the movie is about the final show that they're doing. They're putting on a final Prairie Home Companion. And there's even an angel of death who wanders through the movie.
Yes,
literally.
That's right. I remember that now.
And so it's got all this wonderful kind of resonant, summing up about it. And it must have been Altman was a very cantankerous person, and his movies were too, but there is a sense of mellowness about it, and it must have been a very satisfying Way to go out. It's quite a wonderful movie, I think.
It was very enjoyable, especially for fans of Prairie Home Companion to see a fictionalized version. On your list of notable endings for directors, you have a film that I saw quite some years ago. It was John Huston's final film, The Dead, which was based, if I'm not mistaken, on an Irish piece of Irish fiction.
James Joyce.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
And Angelica was in this.
She is.
Daughter
Angelica
of James.
Huston is in it, and a sterling cast of Irish actors, many of them very little known, but it was something that Huston had wanted to make for a long time, and he had, of course, had a long career, a decades-long career, distinguished director, had ups and downs in his career. At times he was one of those guys who would make bad movies every once in a while, and maybe he just wanted a trip to Africa, and so he went and shot a movie. But he pulled it together, and he was also in failing health, for sure. I don't think he could have definitely known it would be his last film, but it has a tremendous kind of elegiac quality to it, as the story does. That's why you would make a film of that story, I suppose. And it's a real final statement, and it just has the right touch to it, and it's just a lovely film. And it's one of those that if you're an admirer of that director and quite an impressive career, you had to think, boy, I'm glad. Mm-hmm. So cool that it was that one and not one of a half dozen or so duds that, you know, that might have been scattered around his earlier work. Just a really great way to go out. You know, these people who make films, just like writers or other narrative artists, they're in the business of making good endings. I mean, that's one of your big problems with every story you tell or every movie. And so you can't help but think that there must be some sort of satisfaction in creating an ending like that, a meta ending to your career.
We're going to talk about some bad endings in just a second, but I want to touch on two directors that you have on your good list, neither of whom I'm that familiar with. Let's start with Andrei Tarkovsky. The movie is The Sacrifice.
Yeah, a film from the 1980s. Tarkovsky was a mighty figure in Russian cinema, Soviet cinema, if you want to say that. And I think he knew he was dying. He had cancer and made relatively few films, but they're gigantic, very ambitious, very serious films. And so his film, The Sacrifice, is very... he was in exile by this time. He had gotten out of Soviet Union. And so it really has that sense of... not like those previous films where maybe they'd make another film, maybe they wouldn't. Tarkovsky was going to make this a final statement. And so it is big, and it is there's a certain grandness to it and a solemnity to it. And it's really a very powerful film because I think it's one of those movies that even if you didn't know, oh, this director was dying when he made it, you'd know it. You'd know it from the film. You could see that this was someone who was in a rush to get out everything that he had been thinking about and put it into this one movie as a goodbye.
And finally on this list, a movie and a director. I have no idea who these people are. The movie is called Witchfinder General, and probably everybody's jumping up in their chair saying, Marcy, I can't believe you don't know who Michael Reeves is, but I don't.
Well, maybe you know it under its American release title, The Conqueror Worm.
No.
Yeah. It's a film from the late 60s starring Vincent Price, a movie with horror overtones, although other kinds of overtones too. And this is an example of something of a different kind of exit, because this was unintentional. This was a young director named Michael Reeves who had made a couple of horror movies in the low budget realm, and this was kind of a step up for him. And if you look at it, it's a cult movie. It is known by, you know, cultists and people like that. And it is quite an interesting, challenging, difficult film that is clearly the work of some interesting person who if you saw it, you'd say, oh, that person's only 30 years old. Wow, that he's really going to make some amazing movies over the next few decades. And Reeves died of a drug overdose.
Wow.
Not that long after.
That's too bad.
Making the movies, making this film. And so that's it. So that's the close of his career. And so he becomes a figure where you look at what was not at all intended to be a last film.
Yep.
But it's this kind of promise of what might have been and a lost, you know, promise in this case.
So let's just touch on one bad one. We'll give a lot of yay. Those were the good ones. The bad one, a director I love who had an illustrious Hollywood career, Billy Wilder, who ended with The Whimper, Not the Bang.
Yes, yes. Wilder, another a favorite of mine as well. And yeah, his last film was Buddy Buddy, a movie with a couple of actors he'd worked with before, Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau. And it was a remake of a French film that had come out a few years before and is just a very disappointing movie from Billy Wilder, from the great Oscar-winning Billy Wilder, and feels labored, feels... The worst thing about it, it feels kind of out of touch, whereas Wilder in the 40s and 50s was just the most au courant. He had the latest slang in his films, and he knew what was going on in the headlines and all that. And so it's one of those movies that you almost wish they hadn't made it, maybe just because it feels... For me, in no way does it tarnish, you know, the work that these people did before, but you just think, it's just too bad he couldn't have gone out on some really terrific note.
Now, we're going to flip over to actors a second. And there's some of these people on your list, Clark Gable, Richard Farnsworth, John Wayne. I want to touch on John Wayne because here's a guy who spent decades in Hollywood. I can't even, how many? Five? Six.
From 1930 or so to death in 79.
Yeah. And if I say to you, John Wayne, you say cowboy hat. And so this is from a little clip from the trailer for his last movie, which was called The Shootist.
The story of John Bernard Books, the last of the great gunfighters. A living legend. The role is being played by an actor who is himself a living legend. John Wayne.
I won't be wronged. I won't be insulted. I won't be laid a hand on. I don't do these things to other people. I require the same from them.
Okay, so John Wayne, as the voice in the trailer said, himself a living legend, and all of his movies were great.
No, not at all. He definitely made some duds too, and in the last 10 years of his life or so. It definitely made a few where it was kind of treading water there. And I know this because my dad took me to those movies. If there's a John Wayne movie, then my dad wanted to go to the movies during that period. But The Shootist, that narration kind of says it in a way, because that film does feel like it's shaped around John Wayne.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of other people could have played that role, but John Wayne is the guy who is the legend. He is the living legend, and they tie that into the character in that movie. And so it really has a kind of self-conscious feeling of, here's a farewell to someone who's been around for half a century, who's defined a certain kind of character in American cinema like maybe nobody else.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to send him off in this way. And it's got that whole aura hanging around it. So it's a rather nice ending for Wayne. He lived, I think, for three more years after he made it. And maybe he knew that was, you know, that was a good way to end on.
Well, and it's interesting because you have Clark Gable on your list and the movie The Misfits, which is his final film with Marilyn Monroe, I believe, was a great film, and maybe greater than a lot of the films that he made.
It was one of his best, and it was a little bit different from him, although it also uses a kind of Clark Gable persona,
right,
in a way. Also directed by John Huston, who we just talked about, and a film that Gable finished, and I think he died about a week to 10 days after making it. Almost immediately. In fact, some people thought that somehow the exertion of this movie, which was a kind of a required him to inhabit a kind of cowboy physicality, you know, might have hastened the end. Although that's kind of a hard thing to tell. He wasn't very old. He was just about 60. But it's a wonderful now. But of course, so that meant that even audiences who were seeing it for the first time were seeing it as the last film. You know, so they couldn't. No one has ever seen The Misfits without experiencing it with this kind of slightly funereal quality, right?
Because we all know that.
Yeah,
we all knew it when the movie came out.
Yeah, because that was it for Gable, and so it has a certain majesty to it, I think, and he's quite splendid in it.
You know, when we heard this topic as well, all the producers for Weekday said Heath Ledger in The Dark Knight, and you corrected us that this was not his final film, but it does. That is also a film that feels like an elegy.
Yeah, it would have been quite interesting if that had been the last word. He made one more film that he died during the production of Terry Gilliam's film, The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, Parnassium of Dr. Imaginarium.
No, I think it was The Imaginarium, yes.
That would have been, I think it's totally understandable. It's kind of interesting about what our brains do, because we kind of want that to be his
because he won a posthumous Academy Award for that performance.
It was kind of a grand way out and a giant performance and deservedly lauded.
Now, a lot of people might want to, after long careers, that was a short career, but there are long-careered, wonderful actors who somehow let their career peter out. Sir Ralph Richardson is on your list of, ooh, couldn't you just leave well enough alone?
And what was his last film?
A film I've not seen. Give my regards to Broad Street.
See, a lot of people haven't seen that film, and you don't want to see that film.
Okay.
It's a movie that was made by Paul McCartney, who I am second to none in admiring, but he should not be making films because that movie has this kind of dopey, let's make a movie on a Sunday afternoon kind of quality. And Ralph Richardson is in it. So it points to him for being a good sport. But
he had a lauded, notable acting career, stage, film.
Not quite the way you want to remember him.
Now here, this is not a clip of this particular actor, but this is another bad exit. It was Bela Lugosi, the great horror film star. And this movie is called Plan 9 from Outer Space. This, you won't hear Bella, but you'll get an idea of what the film is like.
What do you think will be the next obstacle the Earth people will put in our way?
Well, as long as they can think, we'll have our problems. But those whom we're using cannot think. They are the dead, brought to assimilated life by our electrode guns. You know, it's an interesting thing when you consider the Earth people who can think are so frightened by those who cannot, the dead.
I think we're frightened by more things than that. But
a lot of food for thought there.
Yeah. Yeah, so that wasn't Bela Lugosi, but that had that, when was this movie made, 60s?
The late 1950s, yeah.
And it has that kind of weird professorial tone. Was that an actor in the film?
Oh, it has a lot of that, yes. this was a creation of Ed Wood, the legendary, semi-legendary Ed Wood, and very famously, Lugosi died a few days into filming, but Ed Wood decided to keep his role in it, and he used the three or four shots that he got of Lugosi, and he repeated them during the film, and then he got a stand-in who was his Ed Wood's dentist or his chiropractor or somebody who would come in and hold a cape over his face and enact the role that Lugosi had been enacting.
At a certain point in time, should people retire gracefully from acting and directing?
Well, that's an interesting question, and it leads me to I wonder why I have some of these feelings about, oh, that was a good exit. Why shouldn't someone keep working? You know, if you have to put food on the table, why shouldn't you make cheap horror movies? I mean, it's fine. You know, you're doing your thing. You're not obligated to go out gracefully in any way. I mean, if you're an actor, maybe you just want to act. Maybe you just want to keep working.
A lot of actors say that they're just going to keep going until they die.
Yeah. So as much as I think that we all like stories, and we all like stories with happy endings and all that stuff. But maybe we should step back and not impose that on people's careers. You know, I mean, if you want to make a bad film, or you want to take the paycheck just so you can go to Africa and make a movie,
do it.
Who am I to judge? Why, you know, really, why not? So I take some pleasure in recounting some of these nice exits, but it's fine.
And there you have it. Robert Horton writes about movies for the Everett Herald at his blog, The Crop Duster. And he talks about Cinema Monthly at the Frye Art Museum when he hosts the Magic Lantern film series. He writes books as well. Robert, you're just all over the place. And glad you had time to come in.
Thanks, Marcy.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
No doubt you've heard by now that Amazon's Jeff Bezos has purchased the Washington Post. We'll hear some analysis of that deal and more of the week's business news from economics writer John Talton in a minute here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Hi, this is Peter Sagal from NPR's Wait, Don't Tell Me. In order to keep KUOW and NPR running like clockwork, we count on support from listeners. Every minute of every day is made possible because of listeners like you. And yes, I'm talking to you, the guy on Capitol Hill with the bike. Yes, you. Everybody else, too. I'm talking to all of you. You may have recently received a renewal reminder in the mail. Please mail back your gift or renew online at kuow.org. And thanks from all of us.
71 degrees in Seattle, expecting to reach 85 this afternoon with lots of sun. Overnight, it'll be partly cloudy with a low of 60. And tomorrow, Thursday, some clouds in the morning, then sunny again in the afternoon with a high of 82. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 1042.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Award for Most Startling Business Story of the Week. The announcement Monday that Amazon founder Jeff Bezos spent $250 million of his considerable personal fortune to buy The Washington Post. John Talton is economic columnist for another newspaper, The Seattle Times, a regular guest on our show. And John, I know that the first thing that went through my mind was, gosh, for a smart businessman, newspapers maybe aren't the best investment.
Well, our death has been greatly exaggerated. Newspapers aren't going away. They are going through a tremendous amount of disruption. The old business model has been destroyed, and that old business model was basically you send out mini-skirted ad reps to sell confiscatory ad rates to lecherous old car dealers, and you have 42% profit margins. I'm not talking about my newspaper, which is family-owned and a great paper, but these chain newspapers, these huge national chains dependent on Wall Street, had promised them profit margins that could never be sustained. And once Craigslist came along, it all blew up. And some of us who used to be in management at these big chains, which I shall not name, had warned them about that. So Bezos is in a position where he can do a lot of good for the newspaper industry. If he understands it's also a calling, then so much the better.
Well, you talked about the sort of chains across the country. This is not a chain that he bought, although there are subsidiary companies. He bought what some might argue is the number two national newspaper, the Washington Post.
Well, it used to be. The Post has gone into a very tragic decline. It was a national newspaper. It is now cut back to mostly covering Washington. It still has some excellent features, especially Walk Blog, which Ezra Klein runs, and I'm not envious much. but he certainly has bought a wonderful franchise. I mean, this was the paper that in its glory days brought down Richard Nixon.
Ah, so as you said just a couple minutes ago, he needs to recognize it's a calling as well as a business. And one of the things I also thought about when I heard this news was that what is really different about this purchase is that we've heard a lot about multinational conglomerates buying media outlets. This is not that. This is a guy with his, I mean, he does own a giant company, but this isn't that money. This is his own money.
This is 1% of his personal fortune. 1% of my personal fortune might buy a piece of bubble gum, but I don't know how much it costs anymore. So much for me as an economics columnist. This was a family-owned newspaper, and in a sense, it's going to be a family-owned newspaper with the Bezos family.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the other Washington risks misunderstanding this man. He's not going to buy it as a millionaire's toy, which has happened in some other places. He is a very smart businessman. He has a background in finance. He has a background in tech. And he has a background in supply chain. And, yes, he does think in geological terms compared to what we're used to with Wall Street, where it's quarterly, quarterly, quarterly. He's willing to tell Wall Street to go take a hike on Amazon. But he's very interested in growth, and he's very interested in data, and he will be a demanding owner.
Do you have any sense of his attitudes about journalism? I read somewhere that the only thing people know about Bezos and newspapers is that he reads them.
That's a good start. I'll take that. Well, this is a guy who started out selling books. I don't know if he so much started out selling books because he loved them, although his wife is an author. But he did see that the data showed an opening to make a lot of money and grow a business and find a market niche in selling this product. And he may well see the same thing in journalism. I don't think this is going to be a hobby or a dilettante kind of thing. I also think he will give them some room, but the innovation pace is going to pick up a lot.
What has been the reaction among your fellow newspaper men and women?
Well, we love to talk about ourselves. And so, for instance, NOAA just came out with a report that the Arctic ice is melting at an unprecedented rate. And try finding that on any newspaper site, or especially any of the things we say about ourselves. So this has been written about. But I think in reality, a lot of the journalism community does not know a lot about Bezos. It does not know a lot about Amazon. It keeps talking about Amazon as an online retailer. That's just a slice of what Amazon is. And there's a lot to talk about, but there's not a lot yet that's really known.
Well, I'm sure that people will be following it, or at least watching it, because it's such an interesting thing to have happen to the newspaper industry and the Washington Post particularly.
Well, I was reminded of the scene at the World Trade Center site where George W. Bush, when he was still beloved, he's talking on the megaphone, and they yell at him, "We can't hear you." And he gets on the megaphone and he says something like, "Well, the world is about to hear us now." And I thought about that in terms of Seattle. Suddenly, the other Washington and the East Coast is going to hear Seattle.
We're talking with John Talton, and we'll leave Jeff Bezos and the Washington Post and Amazon for a second and jump over to housing, because there's such interesting and confusing news for me. The housing market in June apparently is the best since 2008, the official start of the recession. And this is in all measures, right? New starts, existing home sales, everything.
For the most part, yes.
What part isn't in there?
You can slice the bologna in a whole lot of ways. I mean, the number of bank-owned properties is still very high, and it's also very opaque. So we don't know how much inventory the banks are holding back, and the inventory is undoubtedly higher of these so-called REO properties than it was in 2008.
How does the housing market itself fit into the overall economy when you're taking its pulse?
If you look at the post-World War II era, housing has always been a very important part, and it's been a leading indicator of recovery. So housing has always mattered a lot. If you look at the American economy since 2000, since China entered the World Trade Organization and our manufacturing really, really cratered. Housing has become our last big factory town all across the country, and it has assumed this much larger importance to the economy than it probably should have in terms of jobs. And this is soup to nuts jobs, from the framing crew all the way to the home improvement store and all of these private contractors. So it's a big deal.
So it's better than 2008, but it's not, I mean, as I understand it from the articles that you sent me and things that I've been reading, things are better, but not nearly at the place where they were a decade ago before all this started to happen.
Right, or even 2006. We're digging out of a very deep hole, and we have to remember that Seattle is special. There's only so much land. It's a very affluent community. Go out into the exurbs and you'll still see empty subdivisions. As I wrote, our long national housing nightmare is over, channeling Gerald Ford. But we're digging out of a very, very deep hole, and we're not going to go back to the big house flipping. Here's an interesting subplot to this. our friends among the Wall Street Boys, B-O-Y-Z, are going around the country and they're snapping up thousands of houses that they're going to then rent out. They're going to take the rents and use that as an income stream to securitize and sell to investors. What could possibly go wrong?
I recently was learning why our banking system is in such a state, but I just a sort of ancillary comment. I hear that Bank of America is about to face a suit for defrauding some of its investors, but we're talking upper level. We're not talking about the people who maybe had a home loan from them and can't reach them on the phone to try to.
Right, exactly. Well, I mean, you know, nobody went to prison. Nobody is doing hard time with a cellmate named Big Nate. They got away with it, and the system has not been reformed. It's just that the housing sector is in such a deep hole that it'll be a long time before we have another housing bubble collapse. We'll have other bubbles collapse.
Well, one bubble that doesn't seem to be puffing up again is consumer spending, which is another big percentage of at least the GDP in the United States. And it sounds like it was up, it's down, but up was like by a percent or two, not, you know, nobody's running out and buying new refrigerators or cars.
You are absolutely right. At this point in the typical post-World War II recovery, we used to just say post-war, but we've had so many wars
yes.
that now we have to say the other. Consumer spending would have been roaring ahead, and it hasn't happened. It's been moving ahead on an annualized basis of maybe 1.9%. This is holding back recovery, and it's not surprising. When we had the collapse in 2008, we had an incredibly deep demand hole. People lost their jobs. They lost 40% of their household wealth. Since then, the Fed has propped up the economy with a lot of stimulus, expanding the monetary base. This has done a lot of good. It's prevented really serious deflation. It's caused a bull market on Wall Street. But the average consumer may not have a job, has seen his or her income stagnate, may be worried about losing a job, and all of this is keeping consumer demand down.
But there's something else, and that's debt, right? Consumer
Absolutely.
Debt. So how does, I mean, debt comes when we spend money, but did we reach a tipping point where all of a sudden everyone went, whoa, I owe $50,000 in credit card fees and bills. I can't spend any more money.
I think that's part of it. There has been a lot of so-called deleveraging, people paying down debt since the Great Recession, or as I call it, the Panic of 2008. And this is continuing to go on, but we still have incredibly high consumer debt. If you look at the consumer debt that was around in the 60s, 70s, it was very low as a percentage of household income or as GDP. It has risen ever since then to, you know, 120% levels because our wages have stagnated in general, or they have risen very slowly. This ongoing income inequality to keep up with the Joneses and to continue our consumer economy. First, both people in the household had to go to work, and then they started taking on debt.
We were encouraged. You conjured that image of George W. Bush with his megaphone on top of the ruins of the World Trade Center. Americans were exhorted to shop after that. That was going to be something that repaired our country.
Isn't that amazing? You know, don't drive less and take the bus so that we can, like, withdraw from the Middle East, go shop. But consumer spending accounts for 70% of gross domestic product.
So if consumer spending does not go up more than 1.2%, which I think was the figure from the last quarter, housing market is up. What is the prognosis then for this economy growing at some rate that somebody deems very healthy?
Well, it's not healthy. When you have an economy that's growing at 1.4%, and I think The average growth rate annualized over the past 60 years or so is 3.9%, and that includes parts of the Great Depression and a bunch of recessions. That's not good, and the consumer spending, the debt, the job situation, and the federal austerity are all holding this back.
A last question I have has to do with that, you know, we are the 99% slogan that we heard so much about. I mean, now you hear it and it just kind of washes over. But is that really the percentage of the American population? Somebody's enjoying this recovery. Maybe it's the bankers. I don't know who, but Wall Street's gone nuts. So somebody's making money. Is it 99% of us who are not?
Sure feels like it in journalism. But if you slice and dice it into income quintiles, which is what economists do, then the two top quintiles, let's go into the upper 20%, they have seen gains and steady gains ever since the 80s. Once you get into the lower three quintiles, they have pretty much stagnated and the lowest quintile has gone down.
So that's 80%, maybe not 99%, but 80-some
percent. 75-80%.
And with that cheery news and statistic, we say thank you very much for coming in and cheering us up to no end. Well, if you're a journalist, you can look at the Washington Post and Bezos and think about the future. John Talton writes about the economy for the Seattle Times and on his blog. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks, Marcy.
Weekday is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi, and Andy Hirst. Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. I'm Marcy Silman. Tomorrow, as the ring cycle continues at Macaw Hall, we look at the guy who wrote it, Richard Wagner. Hope you can join us.
Today, President Obama talked about the housing market in an online forum on the website of Seattle-based Zillow. We'll have more on that in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Derek Durr has had a busy summer so far. He knocked out three opponents in the Chicago Golden Gloves Championship, and he brokered a treaty between two rival gangs in his Southside neighborhood.
It was just basically saying how we need to stop trying to shoot at each other, kill each other. It's senseless. We can't win.
Coming up on the story, the anatomy of a peace agreement at the street level.
That's 2 p.m. today on KUOW2. Discover KUOW's second program service online at KUOW2.org.
Support for KUOW comes from Sound Theater Company, presenting The Wild Party, a musical by Andrew Lippa based on a banned poem about a troupe of thrill-seeking burlesque performers in the 1920s. August 8th through the 25th at the Center Theater at the Armory. More at soundtheatercompany.org.
It's 71 degrees in Seattle. Forecast says we're going to get up to 85 this afternoon with sun. Tonight, a few clouds with a low of 60, and tomorrow, Thursday, some clouds in the morning, then mostly sunny again in the afternoon with a high of 82. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.